Okay, we're recording. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Excited to have a conversation.
No, it's my absolute pleasure. And shout out to James for putting us in touch. It's been a really fun process reaching out to previous guests saying, who would you like to see on the podcast? And I get introduced to people like yourself that I would never have otherwise come across. And it's that like one degree of separation. And I might do it with yourself later and suddenly you'll introduce me to someone else. So awesome to have you on. I did a bit of research in that I watched the episode that you shared with me of the podcast you were previously on talking about biohacking. And there was some awesome stuff in there that we'll kick off with today on this conversation, which was the idea of microdosing mushrooms. Like, how in the hell did you get into that as a vibe? And what are the benefits you've got from it?
Yeah, I mean, okay, there's a little bit of a long story leading up to it, I guess, if that's okay to go on a bit
of a
tangent. Yeah,
I'd love as much context as possible is best.
Okay, amazing. Well, you know, my entire life, I was kind of just drawn towards something. And I didn't know what it was, but I could feel it. And I found there were so many holes in the way that I understood the world and the world was being described to me. And I could feel like there was this rationality behind it all, but there wasn't this heart to it. And just being very atheistic in my upbringing as well. And once I started to like get into my late teens, I became, you know, it's like teenage angst, you know, that people talk about. It was more like existential dread to some degree, where it was like every possibility that I could see in front of me as a path to walk, I just knew wasn't the way. And so from my atheistic point of view, I was like, okay, maybe quantum mechanics will have some of the answers that I'm looking for. So I actually went to university and like I have a degree in quantum mechanics because I thought maybe academia had some form of answer for me, you know, and really at the end of the day, all I was looking for was the answer to like, why am I here? And it seems crazy that to even ask that in some households is just like, there is no point, you know?
No.
But I really felt it in my soul. And then when I was about 18 years old, I did LSD for the first time. And I was like, okay, this is the thing. Like, it's connected me with the thing that I've been craving my entire life. And I didn't have like the frameworks or the teachers or anything around me to really point me in the right direction. But it was the first like nugget of truth, that first breadcrumb that really like aligned a lot on my path. And then from there, not long after, I heard about ayahuasca. I was listening to a Graham Hancock TED talk about ayahuasca. And this is probably like 2015, I think. And at that time, like psychedelics were still kind of not the mainstream vibe, you know, like it was starting to slowly bubble up. But as soon as I heard about ayahuasca, it was just like everything in my body clicked. And it was like, that is the way. And the thing that really did it was his explanation that, oh, like through digging into it, it was like, how did they find ayahuasca? This combination of this vine and this plant in the Amazon, which has like insane biodiversity, that this combination in this way of making it creates this super profound experience. And the answer that all the indigenous give is just the plants told us. And I'm like, there has to be something going on here that I'm missing, you know? So as soon as I finished university, I flew out to South America and I went and lived out in the jungle for 3 months, working with jaguars. And I was like walking them on leashes in a rehabilitation sanctuary.
Wow.
And then I ended up going and living with the indigenous and drinking medicine, and just everything just aligned from that point on in my life forward. Wow. And there was lots of like medicine and ceremony in this path being walked. And the microdosing actually came like not at the end, but further down, where it was like the way that I learned how to be in ceremony and the way I learned how to interact with like the plants and nature and the spiritual side of things really taught me like how to be with the mushrooms, because there is no teacher, you know, like at least there wasn't for me. Like there's Mexican lineages that carry that medicine of like the psilocybin mushroom, and that wisdom is passed down over generations. And just as an example, like the lineage that I work with, ayahuasca, they're an unbroken lineage, a family bloodline that goes back to the Incas. So like when you think about how to fine tune and like become masterful of like how to do healing with this, they've done like every trial and error experiment you could ever think of. So when they get down to like now from that bloodline, there's so much intelligence there. And then I tried to basically bring that into the world of microdosing.
Well, about a ton of questions come out of all of that. I love, which way do I go? So, okay, ayahuasca. I love the idea that the answer to like, how do they figure it out, was the plants told us. And even that insight is huge, because what do you mean? That's not possible. It must have been a scientific study where they've got a peer-reviewed journal. You know what I mean? Like that academic world is just, it's completely computer says no when it comes to intuitive decision-making like that. And I'm intrigued as to whether or not you've come across other situations like that. But equally, like, what is an ayahuasca ceremony actually like? It's not something I've personally done. So if you could take me back to that moment when you're, you know, living with the indigenous for the first time, actually doing this stuff.
I mean, how I would approach it now is very different to how I did as a rogue 22-year-old going into the jungle.
Yeah, fair enough.
Maybe
you could give me like the most rogue version and then like what it would be like now.
Okay, yeah. So I went out there with no connections to anything. And I really I knew that it would appear when it was meant to, you know, and it just came through a recommendation and from someone that I met while traveling. And I didn't speak really any Spanish. And they spoke almost no Spanish as well. They spoke Shipibo. They're native out there, you know. So I flew into Iquitos, which is the largest city in the world not accessible by road. So there's like almost 1 million people out there, and the whole place is just like tuk-tuks and motorbikes because they can't get cars there.
Wow.
So I end up in Iquitos. I go to the edge of Iquitos in a tuk-tuk. I get in a boat. They take me 3 hours upriver, and then I hike an hour into the jungle. Then I'm in the center, and I have no idea about ceremony. I have no idea what I'm meant to be doing. I don't speak any Spanish. They hardly speak any Spanish. So there's no communication happening.
Whoa.
And they're kind of just pointing me like, gringo, go here, gringo, go there. And then like, they just started pouring medicine, and I would just like fast in a hut during the days, in isolation, and it was no electricity, no power, no Wi-Fi, nothing like that. Right. It's just rogue.
Whoa.
And now the way that, you know, I approach it, it's like, I have a very good understanding of how the ceremonies take place. I have a very big network of like curanderos, like in the family lineage that I work with. And like, you know, we go to like very nice events and like book out beautiful centers, and there's really nice meals prepared, and everything's very orchestrated.
Wow. Yeah. That's chalk and cheese, isn't it? Holy shit. So it's the kind of thing, it's like, don't tell mum. You know, it's like I'm getting the tuk-tuk to the very edge of town and going as far away as possible from where I should probably be. And so how did you know? Obviously, you just had to have faith that what they were giving you was what you needed to take. And so how long, like it's like a 12-hour process or 18 hours? Like what actually happens?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, it's like a 4 to 6 hour experience. But it can kind of like linger for longer than that, like sort of sparkle. Like you stay kind of in that spirit realm to some degree. But to be honest, I was at a point in my life, and I think everyone to some degree hits a limit of like, I don't like what I'm doing. I need to make a change. You know, I need to find the path that I'm meant to be walking. And I just think I hit that really young for whatever reason. And I was like, I wasn't like suicidal by any means, but like I was more or less like ready to die for the wisdom that I was seeking. So I wouldn't recommend approaching it like that. That's just what I did. But the ceremony
is cool. I mean, that's massive to even state that. Like, so explain what you mean by that. That you were ready to die for the wisdom that you were searching for.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, like, you know, I grew up in Sydney and middle class family. Everything was like pretty good. Home was pretty good. I just never found like my thing. And I like always had this like very strong intuition as to like how I approach the world, but there was never a framework to place that in, you know, like as a physicist, you look at the world, even like a difference between classical physics and quantum physics. Classical physics says reality is real and we observe it. So this is like ball go up, ball come down. Quantum physics says the observer's participation is required to create reality. Right? So it's actually a stream of consciousness, like coming from us as the observer. But when you hold this idea of intuition next to physics, it doesn't really make sense because like they don't fit into the same system. So one has to change. So for me, it was like I had to remove the side of like materialism and allow more space for the human experience. And that become like my main driving force. So yeah. Yeah.
And what were some of the, it sounds almost like everyone, the journey they go on is through the ups, the downs, the twists you don't expect to happen. What were some of the hardest moments that you remember by taking that approach?
I mean, like a big piece, especially just from like the scientific perspective, right? And this is like the difference. My perspective now is direct experience is everything. Like it is king. You know, like you don't know anything unless you have direct experience. You can go and read 10 books about ayahuasca, but if you don't like participate in the ceremony, you'll never understand what that means, you know? And I would say that is true to almost everything. Direct experience is the thing, and the human experience is the thing, and everything else kind of just fills in around it. So when we have this perspective of like physics, there's no room for the human experience. There's no room for emotion, right? And it also, in its very nature, it tries to cut everything and isolate everything. You know, it's like, how does this work in this isolated environment? But everything exists in relation.
Yeah, trade-offs everywhere. And what I love about this as well, just some of the words, just to cycle back to your opening kind of introduction, was things like healing and wisdom and intelligence. And I'd love to uncover what you mean by that, because in some ways there'll be, you know, okay, so I grew up in and around London. I'll have friends sitting in a pub there who will think that going and doing ayahuasca in South America is for a bunch of nut jobs that don't do fucking anything all day long. You know what I mean? Like, and you'll have mates in Sydney that are similar. It just like completely, that is bullshit. But like wisdom, healing, intelligence, they're very, very important things. So if you embark on a journey of, I mean, this is specifically ayahuasca I'm asking about here, but I guess it's more of like the healing journey itself. Like if you meet someone from a lineage back to the Incas that are healers that have been trialing different things in different ways over every single generation. Like, what are you tapping into there in terms of wisdom and in terms of intelligence?
Yeah. I think a big piece to healing is like, there's so much fluff around healing now as well, just in like the holistic space kind of opening up. But really at the end of the day, healing is becoming more of who you are and having the ability to do what you want to do. You know, and we all have these like invisible tethers almost pulling us, you know, like the shoulds of society and the shoulds of our parents and the conditioning and the programming that we've been raised with. And whether you like it or not, you're being drawn by them. And for me, like healing isn't necessarily about like overcoming symptoms, right? Like it's about regaining your free will and your sovereignty to make choices that are for you, you know? And although the symptoms arise, like this idea of healing, like to heal is to be sick. And it's not necessarily true. It's like, as I heal, I get more clear. And like clarity affects everything. And I guess one of the things that the Incas say as well, like the one that they have four laws, it's family, community, work, and ceremony. And your work must benefit your community, but the most important is ceremony. And you go, huh, I would think it's family. You know what I mean? But if you're not pure in who you are and the way that you express yourself, and if you're not energetic and able to go out and work and like gather and hunt for your family and all of these things, and you have like neuroses and depressions and anxieties, you're no good for your family. You're no good for your community. You're no good for your work, you know?
Yeah, it's that brings to mind the idea of, if you want to fix the world, first you have to look at yourself. And it's often not what people want to do, right?
No, all you can do is look at yourself.
That's true. Absolutely, isn't it? Well,
like, try and fix someone else.
I was thinking, actually, Matt, I need to pull up my phone. So my current screensaver, why is it not there? It's supposed to say what you want, right? Just to remind myself, like, just cut all the bullshit out and just focus on what you want. And it's a work in progress, obviously. But
always,
some of the things that you're saying are really resonating, because it's not information that's readily available when you go through a traditional schooling system and whatever the case that you might have been from Australia or from the UK to get to even having these conversations. And so what I'd love to understand a bit more then, Matt, so the 22-year-old hero that just like threw himself in the deep end, a number of years have gone by since then. So what have you done with yourself in that period? There's obviously been a lot of learning, but did you incorporate these things into a skill set that's now a day job, or how have things kind of panned out?
Mm-hmm. Well, throughout that experience, from there onwards, like there's been a lot more medicine being poured, you know, and like I've partaked in many, many ceremonies since then. And my work with the plant medicines, and also like just guiding other people through, and my friends and family, you know. But for me personally, like, I am like a freedom maximalist. Nice. And I really believe in like building the dream and like whatever that looks like. So for me, what that ended up being was actually the first step was like, I need to work out how to make income from anywhere in the world, because then I'm like location free. So I ended up learning like web design and a bunch of e-commerce skills. So I now live in Costa Rica. And I make a US salary plus, and the cost of living is very low. So my ability to save is so high, and my flexibility to like move around the world is so strong. And then also that skill set very much aligns with things just need to be done. I kind of go into companies almost like an entrepreneur and like fix marketing funnels. And then that way I can also choose who I want to work with. So I have like the who, like the where, and then the when is also things just need to be done. And like, I'm in my time zone, and if they get done, they're done. So that's like opened the entire world for me.
Cool. And there's something so powerful in that, isn't there? Of the location dependence. I've been working on a vision, something to set like a proper 10-year long. Okay. This is what I'm working towards. And part of that is the freedom to go where I want when I want, freedom to work on what I want when I want, freedom to spend what I want when I want, and the freedom to say what I want. And the location bit that you've just touched on is a big part of that. Like, well, if you were tied into a job that gave you 22 days holiday a year in a physical location, like, what? That's not freedom, right?
No.
You're stuck in a world in which you have no ability to go anywhere or do anything. And I just, to echo your point, I knew I couldn't do that. Many years ago, I started making decisions to get out of that particular world. And it's taken 10 years, frankly, of like trying to figure out how to actually do it. And so teach me, I'm actually not far away in that I'm in Mexico at the moment, traveling with my family. What's life in Costa Rica like?
Oh, it's amazing. I love it. I've been there for all 3 years.
Is James there with you at the moment?
He just moved. He's now my neighbor.
Yeah. Cool. No way. Nice. Shout out, James. Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
To someone who's never been to Costa Rica before, like living as a digital nomad, I guess is one way of describing that. What's it like?
I love it. And one of the reasons that I love it is it's kind of got this nice balance of like Western influence and then like very authentic roots. So it's very easy to live there. You know, you can still go to Costco if you want to, and like you can still do all the things that kind of like Americans would want. You can also drink the tap water and just like a few little pieces that go a long way. But the slogan of the country is Pura Vida, right? It's like the pure life. And the way that they construct their culture, or their culture is constructed, it's always family first and then business. You know, it's like if you meet someone and you want to do business with them, it's always, how's the family? Always.
Interesting.
Whereas in the West, we're so quick to be like greedy, you know, and like, how can I get what I want out of you and just move on? And everyone's so money focused. And it's really nice living in a country where I work like a Westerner, you know, and then as soon as I walk outside, it's peace. And it goes a long way. And then also, I'm very much like a Bitcoin maximalist. And the integration of Bitcoin into Costa Rica is arguably like the best in the world, maybe outside of El Salvador.
Wow.
So
let's follow that. So yeah, go on. So what does that actually mean on a day-to-day basis in terms of using Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm in a position where a lot of my salary is in Bitcoin, and I can pay my rent in Bitcoin. I can pay my groceries in Bitcoin. I can buy my furniture in Bitcoin. I'm almost on a Bitcoin standard. My need to interact with banks and fiat money in general is very, very small.
Interesting. I'd actually describe that as a Bitcoin standard already. Mm-hmm. Like, in my view, like a Bitcoin standard is when Bitcoin is your savings base case and you can use it as and when you choose to. Inevitably, there'll be some services where you just can't use Bitcoin. You can't use your air miles with Bitcoin or something. You know what I mean? There's always going to be some form of quasi money that exists that's like, no, this is our special little system. You buy a ticket to go to the Australian Open and you walk around with a fucking wrist card because that's how you pay for it, or something like that. Epic. Yeah, nice. And a big thrust of this podcast is Bitcoin. Like, it comes up all the time as the most incredible investment you could possibly make. But one of the things that's often criticized for is its ability to fulfill the medium of exchange feature of money. But you've just described very well that that's not the case. And so what does it mean then in terms of Costa Rica? So the government there, they're not anti-Bitcoin, or the financial system is such that they'll just never catch up and everyone's already using Bitcoin. So, you know, what are they going to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely not anti-Bitcoin, but to some degree, what happened was like during COVID, there was so many people from the US and Canada who wanted to make their exit, and they ended up in Costa Rica, and they were all the people who were holding all the Bitcoin, you know? And they were like, well, we want to use this. So they literally just created all the technology and the companies and the third parties to just make it accessible. So one of the beautiful things is like the Bitcoin jungle down there is an app. And if you are the, like the merchant and I'm buying something from you, I can send Bitcoin and you receive dollars or colones. So they don't even need to be connected to the network, but that like exchange is there.
Interesting. So that's almost like a fiat rails app that enables people that haven't yet adopted Bitcoin to happily use it.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of like the business that Parker Lewis is building called Zaprite that's helping people take funds in fiat if they choose to, but also charge customers in Bitcoin. and it's just, I used it literally just today for a product. You're like, oh, that's so cool, isn't it? It's like you could just pay using like almost a Stripe type feature where you put your credit card in and boom, off you go, or use Apple Pay, but actually go this way and you can use Bitcoin. It's one of the things that gives me such confidence that the future is already here, essentially. People just haven't quite yet realized it. And okay, so Matt, so here's a question for you. I am currently tax domiciled in Australia. So my wife is Aussie. I spent the last 5 years living in Australia. We've had three young kids, so we'd be very much like pregnancy focused and family stuff. But getting to that point now, it's like, okay, well, we don't own a home. We moved into Bitcoin very specifically. The purchasing power has surged very nicely. I'm super happy with all of that. But why give 30, 40% to the Australian government every year for the next 10 years? So did you have a specific thought process that you went through when you left Australia? Maybe it was a long time ago and you didn't really have to think these things through. But living outside Australia, why did you choose to do that?
I mean, a big piece of like why I also make decisions at the end of the day is like the main responsibility I see for the individual is their own evolution. And I feel like the lessons that I learned in Australia, like I kind of got to the end of what it had to teach to some degree of just like the collective consciousness and the culture and the way of living. Luckily, my exit was actually super simple. You know, I was 22 when I left and I didn't go back.
Wow.
I've like created everything on the road that I have now. But yeah, like that question of like 40%, does the government deserve that? And that's a big one to answer. If I'm just being real, like, no, you know, they don't. Living abroad, definitely not.
Yeah. I mean, if one's going to travel a lot throughout the year, I think there's a cutoff point of 180 days or something that, if you were to be in Australia for under 180 days a year, you're not on the election roll. You're not using Australian health insurance. There's a whole bunch of things that you've done to say, I no longer live here. You could, in theory, be non-tax resident. It's a commitment, but it could well be the right one. I'm very much feeling into it now. What you might know about, though, is so how does it work living somewhere like Costa Rica? Is there visas and are you paying like local taxes or you just do it all internationally and just kind of cruise around wherever you feel like?
I mean, I mostly cruise around, doing wherever I like the wind takes me to some degree.
Awesome.
But Costa Rica is very easy where you can get a 6-month tourist visa, instantly. And you can leave for one day and get another 6 months and come back in.
Wow.
But okay. I leave so frequently. I'm always flying around doing different things that I never have to like do a border run. And just like home base is Costa Rica. And I've never had an issue, you know?
Interesting.
And because none of my income is domestic, it doesn't actually matter.
Yes. Okay. Nice. Cool. What a great setup you're building for yourself, Matt. So an area that I wanted to talk to you about that came up in the podcast episode you kindly shared with me was the idea of trauma. And first of all, I'd love to understand, like for the audience out there, like what is your definition of trauma, if there was one? And then through some of these psychedelics, et cetera, you've been playing around with, playing is probably the wrong word, like actively using, how does it help with trauma?
Yeah, I think trauma really is, it could just like build on that idea of like those invisible leashes to some degree that get placed on us. And like some of them can be very small. We think trauma like a traumatic experience, like a car accident or the loss of a partner or all these things, you know, but it can even be like a memory when you were 6 years old of your father yelling at you, you know, but it's just these little beliefs really that we're running like a program that really don't serve us to where we want to go. And that's really it, you know, like it doesn't have to be this big, crazy thing. It's just like, how much free will are you able to express? And every time you like start something new and you feel all of that resistance, can you continue to work through it and like evolve?
The feeling that comes to mind, I almost can't say it. It's like, I can't do this. you know, you have an idea, you're like, oh yeah, I can do that. And then suddenly it's like, no, you can't. Comes straight into your mind and tells, like, and it can be, well, anything a parent said to you before, or a sibling, or just any small thing, couldn't it? Well, yeah, it could be, of course, stored in your body. But and so when it comes to using ayahuasca, for example, like, how does it actually help with moving trauma?
Mm-hmm. So there's actually lots of plants that they use in, like, the world of ayahuasca. It's an entire medical system to some degree. And ayahuasca is forgiving vision. So, like, if the maestro, the shaman, the curandero, is like, they drink the medicine as well, and the medicine sees what, like, is imbalanced in you energetically, you know. And the same way,
I mean, literally walk into a room and they can feel it.
Yeah, like, they will sit in front of you and look through you like an x-ray.
Wow.
You know, and they will be like, oh, there's, like, a density in some area of your body, and they will start singing into it, and you feel the density start to move.
Love,
right? And they're literally pulling it out of you, and you'll puke and, like, remove that energetic from the body. And when you see a lion takes a gazelle, right, and then the gazelle goes down, and then for whatever reason, like, there's, like, the fight, flight, or freeze, it's frozen. And then for whatever reason, the lion gets distracted and moves off, and the gazelle makes a run for it. As soon as it gets back to safety, it falls to the ground and has a seizure. And it is, like, releasing all that tension, that energy that was, yes, like, came from that response. And they've actually tracked them in slow motion. And the micro movements they make are actually, like, the movements of fleeing. So it's almost like re-corrects the system to be like, I escaped properly. Whereas we're so mind-driven as humans that we take these experiences and they just loop in our brains over and over and over again. And all these emotions arise, and we're so disconnected from our body that, like, the body doesn't lie, right? But our beliefs do. And, like, the way that we interpret our emotions do. So, like, you will feel some energetic when someone says something to you, and it arises in the body. And what needs to happen is it just needs to be felt physically. Like, what is the sensation in my body? Okay, my body has communicated to me, release. Whereas we go, and then this, and then this, and then this, and you just start spiraling, you know? And sometimes you spiral, like, until you literally pass out from exhaustion. Right. And all that's required is actually just coming back to the body and allowing the nervous system to settle and reset like the gazelle.
Such an interesting example you used there, because I had a chiropractor in Melbourne, Simon, shout out to Simon, who was talking me through, you know, typical symptoms be like IBS, right? Why is your digestive system all over the place? And he's like, well, think about it, like the lion and the gazelle. Like, what's the first thing that the gazelle does when the lion starts chasing it? Well, it shits itself. When you're in a state of fight or flight, there is not any energy in the body to digest. That is the first thing that it doesn't need to do. So it stops doing it and just gets rid of it all. And it's so true, isn't it? That idea that the physical process of, like, throwing off the emotion actually clears it. Whereas we just hold it all inside ourselves. I've done some really interesting work on myself the last couple of years about emotions specifically, and trying to recognize that it's okay to have emotions. Ultimately, they are our responsibility, no one else's. But, like, simple things like going and screaming into a pillow is actually really freaking helpful, especially with, like, tiny kids that come and, like, chomp at your ankles, seemingly the most annoying times. You, like, kick them off. Actually just go and scream in the pillow. It's kind of similar to what you're describing. Do you have
I just puke in a bucket.
Yeah. so when you do this ayahuasca ceremony, I'm very intrigued. It's something I think I have to do at some point. Is it something that you do once a year as, like, a kind of purging process? Like, you might do, like, a, you know, water fast for, like, 7 or 8 days once a year?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people come to the medicine for a lot of different reasons. You know, they come because they want to, like, mend a relationship that's bothering them. And maybe they can't do it with the external person. So, like, it helps them process that. And some people come and, like, they have maybe some, like, depressions and anxieties, and they like just get more clarity and like do the healing work of like sort of cutting those tethers and like removing the beliefs that no longer serve them, and like the habits and actions that they're doing, they get more like clarity on, more perspective why they may be doing it. And then like from there, make a change rather than using force. But then there's others who I would put myself in this camp who really want to learn like this way and like the depths of reality and consciousness. And there's really no end to it. You know, like the top of my lineage, like the Grand Poobah Dumbledore, he drinks 5 nights a week. They drink 300 nights a year.
Wow.
So you really, it just depends on what you're trying to get out of the medicine to some degree. But very quickly, you realize that it's a way of life, like learning how to be better and learning how to clean. It isn't this one-off experience. Wow, that was amazing. I'm healed. You know, like we're constantly evolving as individuals. And every time you go back to the medicine, you just get a little bit more clarity.
Yeah, so that resonates very strongly. Like you can't just click your buttons and heal, obviously. It takes a lot of work and some dead ends, right? You do certain things for a certain period of time, like that was actually a complete waste of time. But somehow in the work, you can get better, essentially. And so another area that I was keen to get more of an understanding around is then microdosing. Mm-hmm. So if you're microdosing, like what is that? And I heard you mention that you've done it for a full 365-day period every single day. It's like incredibly disciplined to do that. How does it make you feel? And what are some of the benefits from it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just slight correction. Not every single day, 5 days a week.
Okay.
You need to take rest days. Because we build tolerance very rapidly to the psychedelic medicines, basically all of them. The only one that you don't develop tolerance to is actually ayahuasca, and it gets stronger the more you do it.
Wow.
So yeah, it's like there's the perspective of, which is like kind of arising now in like the culture of like, take this, feel better. But it's like this antidepressant, but it's natural. It's like this medication. It's like this supplement to some degree. And although it has beneficial effects, that's really not what's happening. The mushrooms, they're intelligent. They're conscious. They have a spirit to them. And they help us come back to homeostasis. So if you imagine the brain, right? Once we turn around like 25-ish, the brain stops growing and it's like formed. And all the neurons and how they fire, they're all connected to like the programs that we're running and our memories and our past and all of these things. So from 25 onwards, there's usually not the same level of growth as there is from 0 to 25. And a big part of that is the brain, although plastic, it takes much more energy for the body to actually change the way that your brain works. So you can imagine it's all about efficiency. So you wake up every day in the same place and you go and you wake up and you brush your teeth and you have a shower and you kind of have your routine. You almost fall into an autopilot during that time period.
Yeah, because the brain, the same shit every single day. Yeah.
Yeah. The brain's hardwired that in, you know, like to move that packet of information through a jungle is so much harder than on a highway. So it wires all these things hard. And some of those are really good. Like when you're really, like you've been working out for 10 years, it's easy to work out, you know? When you haven't worked out for 10 years, it's hard to wire that in, right? So it's that same thing, that choice, that pruning. Do I want this? Do I not want this, right? And what the psilocybin does is it goes in and it creates neuroplasticity in the brain. So it allows more areas to start connecting, like especially across the left and right hemisphere. And it also just very subtly like lowers the blood flow to the amygdala, which is our fight or flight fear response. So when that starts to quiet down and then the brain is communicating better, the effect is the default mode network, which is literally like the autopilot setting of the brain, begins to get quiet too. And then you're just like, oh, like I have choice now. And one of the things is when you're in a location that you're very used to, your default mode network runs stronger. You're more on autopilot. People go traveling and they go, I found myself traveling. Yeah. And the reason is that everything's new and it's novel. And the brain, there is no habits built in. So you're experiencing everything like an infant again. And then that's when we're like, oh, I feel so good. I feel so pure. I have so much choice. Everything is so new. There's so much data for me to change, you know? And so the microdosing almost creates that effect in the brain.
It's so interesting because something I find infinitely fascinating is decision-making. And what I'm beginning to realize more and more is that good decision-making is driven by one's mindset, and you can invest in your mindset. And basically how you get up and behave every single day is driven by obviously your own choices, but those choices are things that you can 100% work on. And what you've just described is potentially just another tool in the toolkit of becoming more sophisticated in one's decision-making processes. And it's, yeah, cool. Okay. So would you, after 12 months of doing something like that, what were some of the changes that you saw in yourself as a result?
Yeah. Well, I mean, through that, it's so individual to some degree,
yeah,
you know,
course,
because
yeah.
as these things arise and it's like, I'm getting more choice. It's like the things that, the places where I fall short are so different than where we all fall short as individuals to some degree,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
so
the
it's
things
really
that we want to work on are different. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and everyone finds it through the process. The thing is, like, once you start microdosing and you commit to it for, like, I would say, honestly, minimum 3 months, you know, and like to continue, it only gets better. Right. And it isn't this addiction thing, this idea of I don't want to become addicted to this. You know, it's literally just this tool for balancing. And as soon as it's no longer a tool and it becomes a crutch, it just stops working because the spirit leaves you.
Wow. And so is that what happened? Essentially, you got to about the 12-month mark and you're like, this isn't really doing anything for me any longer.
No, I actually was just like, I'm going to just take a break and integrate everything and kind of see where I'm at to some degree. Mm-hmm. You said a word before, responsibility, right? And especially mm-hmm. as a man, there's not much in life that gives you more meaning than taking on responsibility. In a strange kind of way, like what gives us purpose. And a lot of people see responsibility as like, how do I put this weight on my shoulders? You know, mm-hmm. like responsibility is this heavy thing. But when you break the word down, it's responsibility, right? It happens in the now always. How good is my ability to respond now?
Yeah, the frenetics of it. Now you sit there and say that. I've never broken it in half like that. Whoa. And so what do you mean? The ability of the microdosing helps you to improve your response ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helps you respond better. You're less in your autonomous mind. So like someone would say something and you'd usually get triggered. Anger arises. And then you yes. fall into this way of reacting, like the past is cycling, right? Whereas like we want to like respond, you know, and mm-hmm. you can't respond from like a place of automation. You can only react. So as the microdoses creates more plasticity in the brain and we get better like regulation over our emotions and what triggers us, our ability to respond improves so much. And then over time, you have this plasticity in the brain, but what ends up happening is called neurogenesis. And neurogenesis is now that we're firing these new pathways, it actually helps solidify them. So once we choose the new choices and the new habits and the new way that we want to interact with the world, it helps us actually lock that in. So then when you stop microdosing after a year, like you don't need it ever again for the rest of your life. You know, like you got the upgrade.
Yeah, wow. So it strikes me, it's similar to some stuff I've been working on where with meditation and the ability to essentially upgrade your software. So you can meditate on a specific thing that happened in your life, or you can meditate with someone else who takes you through a process of reflecting on a certain trauma, to use that word again. And by doing so, you're able to actually move the energy and heal it in a strange way. Again, this is a long way from those physics textbooks you mentioned, you know, all those years ago. But what you've just described is kind of similar in that it's actually changing how the brain functions. Wow. And it's also then making me think about the Iceman, Mr. Wim Hof, and how he talks through the ability for cold to do that too. Do you have some friends then, Matt, that you spend time with where you guys are like talking through different ways of doing this? You're testing that. I mean, that is biohacking, right? You're testing it on yourself. When you talk about responsibility, like if you haven't tried it, then you don't know what's going to happen. No, you so can't you teach. Guys are like, yeah.
You okay. can't teach anything you haven't directly experienced. It's a different way of knowing, you know, yeah. like, and the indigenous, they talk about this, the way they learn to use the plants, right? You can go and read a textbook about the medicinal properties of the plants, right? Or a certain plant to cure something, a certain symptom. But how they learn is they literally speak to the plants and the plants speak back. Once you have a one-on-one conversation with a plant, everything changes. You know, your entire reality shifts. You walk outside and the trees are no longer the backdrop. They're like the other actors in the play. We're all in relation. We're all in this together, you know? And like, that's knowing. That's knowing with a capital K. Like, that's wisdom. Knowledge is what you get out of textbooks.
Mm. And so, yeah, well, I mean, I kind of get a bit, in some ways, I'm like smirking a bit. I'm like, oh, what's he talking about? Talking to trees. Just to be blunt with you, I'm like, okay.
I get
then
it.
It's making me think of my mum, who has been talking about talking to trees for as long as I can fucking remember. She'd go and hug trees. You're like, all right, mum, let's do it. And that was more, I think, of a grounding process than anything else. But take me back to a moment where you did that for the first time. Like, mm-hmm. what was going on around you and how did that make you feel?
Yeah. I mean, just to like put it like super simply, right? You can work with like mushrooms or LSD or some of these other, you know, these other medicines. You drink ayahuasca, right? And ayahuasca is there and she will literally just be like, hello. And it's like, okay, this is not what I thought it was, right? And it's like just that simple. Like if you don't believe it, go and drink ayahuasca 12 times and then tell me it's not real, you know?
Yeah, and I don't doubt you in the slightest. Mm. It's more just one's perception of reality gets jogged sometimes. You're like, what? Well, that would be very different. Like for me to walk outside and the trees not to be the backdrop would be a huge shift. That's not to say I'm not up for doing that. I'm just not there yet. You know, these things, they come into your life when you're ready. I fully believe that. And there's certain things that have to have happened before. Maybe this is the conversation where I'm like, okay, Jake, it's time to start looking into this stuff. I mean, that's essentially what this is, actually. So, okay, at 12 months time, we might talk again and be like, yeah, lots of shit's changed.
I think there's a really nice metaphor also to pull here from like the people who really understand Bitcoin of, when you're in fiat and Bitcoin isn't in your awareness, it's very difficult to get a perspective of what the fiat is, right? Yes. Because you're like the fish in the ocean. But then once you have Bitcoin and you can stand on that perspective, you have like this total view of fiat and then everything begins to click. But it's like, you need the Bitcoin to understand money.
As I think through that, it becomes a starker and starker picture the further along the process you get. So like the first time you buy Bitcoin, it's with $10 and, you know, you don't even remember you had it 4 years later or something. And then suddenly it's like, oh, well, actually I earn in it and 95% of my savings are in it. I pay for everything in my life with it and I'm getting richer every day in purchasing power terms. I feel freer and better than I've ever felt my whole life. And you look back at what your life used to feel like, you're like, oh my God, that was intense in terms of like what it made you feel like. And it only, it increases over time. I always love that Jackson, who I previously had on my old podcast, wrote a great article called The Allegory of Plato's Cave, but talks about it from a kind of fiat perspective. It's basically the story of people living in a cave and they're in chains, and one of them gets to the edge and basically wants to escape and goes outside. It's all like nice and sunshiny with beautiful pastures, and is like, oh, I don't like it out here, and goes back inside and, like, you know, straps the chains back on. It's basically the same thing, right? Whoa, okay. So if you went down this more plant medicine route that you're describing, what are the main differences then? Like, because obviously that's a great analogy that I can fully understand from a Bitcoin fiat perspective. So you're describing like a mindset change due to the experience of the plant medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really that idea of direct experience, right? You can never like have a vision and it ever be somehow saved to be rewatched, right? Mm. You can't unexperience the experience. And like once you speak directly with a plant and it communicates to you, and it may not use English, but there's a transmission of information, mm-hmm. you can't unexperience that, you know? And then you see more and more as you go, as you do with Bitcoin. Even like pulling from the Lakota tradition of like Canada and South Dakota, it's like the natives, they always like end their prayers with "all my relations." And when they say "all my relations," they don't mean like me, my grandfather, my uncle. It's all my relations. It's the ones that fly, the ones that swim, the ones that crawl, you know, the four-legged, the two-legged, the trees, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, the rocks. It's all of it. They're all my relations. The world is responding to us. It's not a backdrop.
And so why is it then that this information, and let's use actually a word that came up before, wisdom. So some of the stuff you're talking through today, it's the first time I've ever heard it. So like anything, it's like, okay, there's a data point or a touch point. How many times does it take you to go, oh, I think there's a marketing trope that like you've got to have seen a brand 7 times before you buy from it. And it can be from the radio, the TV, the newspaper, on the side of the tube, and, you know, on a cereal box or something. I don't know. But this would be kind of point number one. But I guess this is a lifelong learning process. Where I'm going now with this question is, why is it that it's indigenous wisdom that you have to go and find in order to gain wisdom? That's very different to what the textbook at school would have said.
Absolutely. And again, it's just like a different way of knowing. And the way that I see the indigenous is like, it's almost the purity of the human being to some degree. And like, there's evolution from that. But if there was a relatively cataclysmic event that took place on the earth, everyone who's specialized in e-commerce, like myself, is ruined. You know what I mean? But like the natives will survive. You know, they are like eternal. The wisdom that they have acquired and that they live by is the wisdom that allows like humanity to continue indefinitely. Whereas everything we do to some degree is a game. We're like playing out a possibility. So
what you mean by that is this idea that like, if you put me in the Amazon rainforest, I would last no time at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I was indigenous to the Amazon rainforest, I'd know what I can eat. I know where I can sleep. I know where I could like house my family. The closer relationship to the land that they have. Is that what you're referring to?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. Like even like the way they create culture and they like are in relation with each other. Like if you imagine tomorrow that like all the electricity went out across the world, like what are people going to do? You know, no one knows how to grow their own food. Yeah. Like it'd go to just absolute chaos. They didn't even have electricity. It makes zero difference to their life. You know?
Wow. And, like, and they have lessons from that. That is it in some ways, isn't it? Like literally, like put me in the jungle, I'm fine.
Yeah, they are sovereign. You know what I mean? Like, really, yeah. They basically are. And it's not that I'm trying to become Indigenous by any mean. Like, I was born the way I was born and I have my path to walk, you know, but there is deep lessons and deep wisdom that they almost run subconsciously. They're not writing textbooks. They just know how to be in the world.
But so, yeah, this is where the kind of, it's not so much an intellectual journey being a podcaster, but more of a spiritual one, because you're trying to uncover wisdom. And that's what this is all about for me. Over the next like 2 decades, I'm just going to keep talking to interesting people about whatever the hell it is that comes up at the time. But it's a search for wisdom in a sense. And some wisdom isn't online. Like it or not, you can't Google search this stuff. And I think more in relation to some of the kind of meditation related stuff that I've been looking into that comes out of the Himalayas. It's not online, mate. You got to go there. And I haven't yet done that. And I will at some point, I'm sure. And the same would apply for what we've talked through today. It's amazing to think, isn't it? And you're absolutely right. Like, what would happen to me if the electricity suddenly disappeared tomorrow? Well, I'd be in serious shit. My wife always jokes, my hands are so soft. It's because I'm a keyboard warrior, right? Uh-huh. I've been able to make my money that way forever. But, you know, I'm not a farmer. I'd be in deep shit if I had to try and figure out how to make my own food.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, and well, farming, awesome. Man, that takes time. You know what I mean?
Need a season. You can't just...
If you need food tomorrow, man, you're ruined.
Yeah, no, and a tractor and some seeds. Oh, there's no electricity, so you wouldn't have to be able to have the tractor. Who knows? Yeah, that's a whole other podcast episode. Well, Matt, listen, mate, it's been awesome to spend some time together with you. Thank you so much for joining me on the pod. And what an awesome journey. It's just, I really, really enjoyed that part where you're telling about, I was 22, and it's the shit you do when you're 22 is crazy, isn't it? But that is something about that. As a young man, you've got to go and like do some shit that people say, don't do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'd never do anything interesting. Awesome. If people wanted to reach out and get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
I have some stuff cooking right now. I'm actually planning on launching my own podcast in like mid-August. Cool. I think I'd have some... I have a handful of cool people that I could have conversations more like this around.
Yeah.
And you can find all the information at mattblanco.xyz.
Cool. Awesome. Oh, well, best of luck launching the pod. So that's in roughly a month. You're going to put something out there.
Yes, sir.
Have you already recorded the conversations?
I have a few already recorded. Well, I'm going to launch a few in the beginning. So
nice. Yeah. Well, in my experience with the podcast, you just got to start throwing shit out there. There's so much procrastination that can go into a podcast project.
Yeah.
No one's looking. Like, you know, the first 10 episodes, it's like episode 1000 where it might get like super saucy in that sense. But mate, best of luck. You'll be a great host, I'm sure. And
thank you very much.
I'll tune in when I see it live. Well, thank you for your time, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.